Stop the podcast.
Stop the podcast.
Hi, everybody. Just to let you know, this episode of Fish is sponsored by TV licensing.
Yes, TV licensing. What are you watching on TV, Andy?
I have been watching a show that's called 2 Weeks in August.
Okay.
Despite it being July at the time of recording.
Oh, you don't have to watch TV shows in the time that their name references.
No, absolutely. I watched The Darling Buds of May in winter. Anyway, 2 Weeks in August. It's a really good series. It's set on a lovely Mediterranean holiday.
Ooh.
And it's a group of old mates from uni who've gathered together. Some of them have got kids. Some of them haven't. Some of them have been going through big life events. And it's one of those amazing pressure cooker series where things just get more and more and more tense.
Oh, those stressful ones.
I love it. I love it.
I love my comedy, I gotta say. So I've been watching Android, which is Diane Morgan's new thing, and I absolutely love it. But I just, for me, I always, on television, watch everything with someone from Bolton in it. That's basically all I watch.
And she's from Bolton?
She's from Bolton.
But in this show, I believe she's a robot.
She's a robot, and it is not certain where in the country she's from.
It depends where the facility is that makes her, I suppose.
I guess so. But what are we actually here to say?
Oh, we're here to say that if you want to watch any of these shows, your TV license covers you to watch over 400 TV channels and everything on BBC iPlayer.
That is incredible.
So 2 Weeks in August has finished going out now, but you can get hold of it on the iPlayer.
If you want to find out more about this, then go to tvl.co.uk/pod.
Now back to the tension and the stress and the misery of this episode of Fish.
Oh, I thought you were referencing Bolton. On with the podcast.
This is CBS Eye on the World. I'm John Batchelor. The Manhattan Project, 1940. The Manhattan Project, the event of the atomic bomb in 1945. The Manhattan Project. Our guide to how to go about artificial intelligence, we're told by esteemed members of the administration and by outside voices. Manhattan Project, yes. This is for artificial intelligence. What we have now is just the beginning. However, I welcome Jack Burnham of the Foundation for Defense of Democracies, writing most recently with his colleague and national interest, Annie Fixler. The Manhattan Project and its success and its lessons are taken very seriously by the People's Republic of China. Jack, a very good evening to you. Yes, it got my attention right away when I read this. What was the Manhattan Project that gave lessons that China is now using as opposed to the other guys? Good evening to you.
Thank you for having me. I think the key lesson that China was able to take away from the Manhattan Project is the importance of harnessing international talent and nurturing it as a strategic force to be put to national uses. I think when the American public thinks of the Manhattan Project, they think of the time between 1940 and 1945 of the mad dash for the bomb, so to speak, that might have been shown in a movie like Oppenheimer. But I think the real lesson to be learned from the Manhattan Project is not simply the last 4 to 5 years of the project, but really going back decades of an effort by the United States to recruit or to be open to scientists, theoretical physicists, particularly from Germany, fleeing persecution from the Nazis, to allow them to emigrate to the United States, to set up laboratories and high-end universities across the U.S., whether those be in California, Chicago, Princeton, as an example, and to really nurture this talent that was then able to both drain Nazi Germany when it eventually started its bomb project, as well as be a strategic reserve that the American government was able to put to use once the project really started to get going in the early 1940s and onwards.
In other words, we're talking about recruiting. What did the U.S. do right then that it's not doing now?
I think one of the key aspects that the United States did right at the time was a willingness to nurture scientific talent without the expectation of an immediate payoff. And I think this is really clear, particularly in the post-war period. So during the Manhattan Project, obviously, there was much more of an openness factor between the United States and Hitler's Germany in terms of a way of attracting scientists, to say the least. At the same time, particularly after the Manhattan Project and after the end of the war, the United States really took on an emphasis on nurturing academic talent. You saw reports like Science: The Endless Frontier, which established the National Science Foundation, amongst other programs to elevate America's science and technological talent. And there was a broad recognition, particularly within the early Cold War period, to have basic science funding be a key aspect of America's military, economic, and technological edge. Now, what we've seen in this administration is, you know, a rise amongst American scientists who are increasingly looking to move abroad to continue their research. We've seen some issues with funding, regulatory uncertainty. And I think a lot of that is driving scientists that either would have stayed in the United States to consider leaving. And a lot of countries, not just China, the EU, France, Canada, have actually really tried very strongly to recruit American scientists, as well as that uncertainty has limited the interest in those coming from abroad from entering the United States and joining its talent pool.
And what is the administration or the universities the administration is being chary to? What are they doing about recruiting? Are they responding in any positive fashion?
So I think there's still a lot of levers that the United States can pull to correct some of these issues on science and technology. The United States has put forth some efforts to advance funding. Just recently, particularly in the House of Representatives, there's been efforts to restore certain funding to NIH, which is a key institution of biomedical research. There's President Trump, during his presidential campaign, actually promised to give every foreign student a green card as an effort to nurture international talent, and recognizing that, you know, as American universities put time and energy and funding into supporting these students, that America should be the one to reap the benefit. So certainly there's been support for this idea. And there's also been a lot of support, particularly amongst certain circles, in terms of gaining via investment from other countries into America's science base. And that particularly comes to AI. As part of trade negotiations, the United States has tried to garner investment from Japan, for example, in very particular industries like semiconductor manufacturing. Taiwan is another example of these types of investments that might lead the United States to, along with its allies and partners, to maintain its edge in science and technology.
There is security concerns. We both know that there are lots of anecdotes about recruitment by state security or something acting for state security. At the college level, undergraduates tell stories. Graduate students tell stories. So what can we do about people who are being targeted by foreign actors?
Certainly. It is certainly a concern. But I think while that is a concern, and there are certain things the United States can do, for example, under the first Trump administration, the United States ran a project called the China Initiative that looked to counter some of the China's industrial espionage and academic espionage. At the same time, though, I think something to be concerned about is not so much necessarily China's illicit means of gaining access to America's science and technology and academic sector, although those certainly exist and they are important, but rather that China has really been pushing quite publicly to recruit talent in ways that the CCP really hasn't necessarily done before. Just recently, China announced plans to launch a new visa initiative in October to attract young science and tech talent. So rather than relying on, you know, illicit means or other types of recruitment projects that operate in the shadows, as Beijing, you know, often used to do and still does to a certain extent, I think something that's really important to recognize is increasingly Beijing doesn't feel the need to operate in the shadows anymore. It feels as though it has both the funding sophistication and can take advantage of some of the dissension within the American scientific community to really make a public push to recruit those individuals.
To your understanding, have you read that what we're doing is driving away potential scientists who are studying here but are rejected because the universities have new rules? Is that happening now, Jack?
I think there's certainly a concern amongst some international students around being able to access funding in particular with some of the budget debates that have been going on in Congress.
Right.
But something I would say as well is that the United States remains the leader in science and technology funding. It remains the place with the deepest capital markets to be able to turn new ideas and inventions into startups and mature firms. The United States remains a leader in AI, despite China's efforts. Right. So while there are certainly concerns amongst access to resources and funding, the United States still has a lot of advantages that it can pull on in its efforts to remain ahead and remain competitive with China in this space.
Jack Burnham, Research Analyst, China Program, Foundation for Defense of Democracies. I'm John Batchelor.
You're listening to CBS Eye on the World with John Batchelor.
Stop the podcast!
Stop the podcast!
Hi, everybody. Just to let you know, this episode of Fish is sponsored by TV licensing.
Yes, TV licensing. What are you watching on TV, Andy?
I have been watching a show that's called 2 Weeks in August.
Okay.
Despite it being July at the time of recording.
Oh, you don't have to watch TV shows in the time that their name references.
No, absolutely. I watched The Darling Buds of May in winter. Anyway, 2 Weeks in August. It's a really good series. It's set on a lovely Mediterranean holiday.
Ooh.
And it's a group of old mates from uni who've gathered together. Some of them have got kids, some of them haven't. Some of them have been going through big life events. And it's one of those amazing pressure cooker series where things just get more and more and more tense.
Oh, those stressful ones.
I love it. I love it.
I love my comedy, I gotta say. So I've been watching Android, which is Diane Morgan's new thing, and I absolutely love it. But I always on television watch everything with someone from Bolton in it. That's basically all I watch.
And she's from Bolton.
She's from Bolton.
But in this show, I believe she's a robot.
She's a robot, and it is not certain where in the country she's from.
It depends where the facility is that makes her, I suppose.
I guess so. But what are we actually here to say?
Oh, we're here to say that if you want to watch any of these shows, your TV license covers you to watch over 400 TV channels and everything on BBC iPlayer.
That is incredible.
So 2 Weeks in August has finished going out now, but you can get hold of it on the iPlayer.
If you want to find out more about this, then go to tvl.co.uk/pod.
Now back to the tension and the stress and the misery of this episode of Fish.
Oh, I thought you were referencing Bolton. On with the podcast.